supposedly because I didn't approve of him, and he didn't want to come between her and her family. She became hysterical and blamed me for ruining her life. She claimed I just didn't want her to be happy, and didn't like the man because I couldn't control him like I did her. It was quite the scene. The next day, she moved out. I wasn't sure that was a bad thing, except that it happened under such acrimonious circumstances. When she told me, a few weeks later, that she was seeing a psychiatrist, I felt relieved. Moving out on her own, in her 30s, and getting into treatment made me think that the whole mess with Eric might turn out for the best. Let me guess. Sally was seeing Dr. Richard Carr, right? Andrea turned to look at Jessica as Dottie exclaimed,
"Why,
yes. How could you know that?" "He's part of my latest troubles," Jessica responded, raising the arm in the sling a little. "I imagine you've heard about the debacle at the top of the Palm Springs tramway." Andrea shook her head no, before Dottie could speak.
"No, I haven't. I don't get out much, nor do I keep up with the news. It's just too depressing most of the time. What did I miss?"
She looked at Jessica and at Andrea, who averted her eyes.
"We were afraid it would upset you," Andrea said, almost in a whisper. "Dr. Carr's dead. He died last week. I'm sure Jessica can give you more details, since she was with him."
There was something odd in the way she spoke that last sentence, perhaps mistrust in her voice, maybe even resentment. "I'm sorry to bring this up, if you felt the need to keep it from Dottie. I hope you don't find this upsetting, but yes, Carr is dead. He, another 30-something female client of his, and I all took a tumble off the mountain last week. His client and I made it. He didn't."
"Well, I'm not sure why you thought that would upset me, Andrea. Dr. Carr turned my daughter against her father. It doesn't surprise me he met with an early, ugly death."
A whoosh escaped from Jessica's lips. There it was. Same guy, same M.O., and tied to Conroy. "I suspected he was in cahoots with Eric, given the way this all unfolded, but I had no way to prove it. Do you?"
"Not yet, but we're working on it. Did Sally meet Carr through Eric?"
"I'm not sure. That's what I figured when Sally said she wanted me to resign from Pinnacle's board, or else. The trouble that had started weeks before finally made horrible sense. By then, it was too late for Harry. My husband wasn't well, and after being accused of raping his daughter when she was a toddler, life was more than he could bear. He went downhill fast."
As Dottie spoke, she clenched her fist, and angry tears flowed. Both Andrea and Bernadette handed her tissues, too small a gesture of support, given the enormity of the burden those words conveyed.
"I'm so sorry. I doubt it will surprise you or make you feel any better to learn that Sally wasn't the only young woman led down that road by Carr, and I'm betting Conroy was Carr's secret partner in at least one more situation involving Pinnacle."
"Another board member?" Dottie asked.
"I think so, but we're still in the process of putting all the pieces together," Jessica replied. Dottie was quiet for a moment. Then she looked up, her eyes wide, as though it had all become clear.
"Ned Donnelly, right? That poor man. I knew something was up, but with all the trouble here at home, I didn't even take the time to ask him what. Now I can see it. The same sad desperation in his face that Harry wore, followed by Ned's unexpected cheerleading for Eric and a surge of enthusiasm for taking Pinnacle public. I didn't get it. Now I do. Who knows how many others he had in his pocket by then? Can't you go to Ned and get him to tell you what's going on? Before it's too late. His daughter must be at risk like Sally."
Andrea looked down and squirmed in her seat. She didn't make eye contact as Dottie shot off a series of questions, becoming more agitated with each one.
"What is it? What else have you concealed? Is Shannon Donnelly dead?"
"We are not sure, Dottie. She's missing, and the police are looking for her. That's all we know for now,"
Bernadette said, reaching out to place a hand over Dottie's clasped hands. Andrea lifted her eyes to meet Dottie's gaze.
We thought we were doing the right thing, keeping trouble from you. Since you stopped following the news, why bring it up?
We?
What do you mean by we? Dottie demanded.
Did I say we? I meant me. It was my decision to keep all of this from you. I consulted with Dr. Woolridge, but he deferred to me. I'm sorry.
Woolridge and I will talk about this later. From now on, don't shield me. I'm not a child, and I still have my wits about me. I'll face whatever I have to face, especially if it involves my friends and family. Have I made myself clear?
Andrea glanced up and nodded. For a split second, her eyes darted Jessica's way. She was angry and fearful. Did she think Dottie would fire her?
Dottie, I can understand why you're disappointed in Andrea, but it sounds like she's been doing her best to decide whether to draw your attention to these disturbing events. None of it happened too long ago. Shannon Donnelly disappeared Thanksgiving weekend. The investigation into her disappearance is still underway. The young woman with me up on Mount San Jacinto last weekend said some things that make it sound like Shannon is dead. She's not a reliable source, however, and for the moment, at least, the police can't question her further.
I guess I'd better pay attention to the news again. Maybe if I act more like my old self, I'll be treated that way.
Alexis is a fortunate woman that her daughter is still in one piece. She deserves a break, given all she's dealing with. At least she's back in rehab.
Dottie sighed. I'm surprised she didn't hide her current troubles from you. She's not big on sharing bad news. Jessica felt uncomfortable saying those words.
She wouldn't hide that from her old pill-popping drinking buddy, who stayed on the wagon despite the tragedy of the past couple years,
Dottie said, sipping her tea. Jessica must not have hidden her shock.
Why do you think I'm serving you tea, dear, rather than some delightful vintage from our wine cellar?
She took another sip.
It has been a struggle. The doctors don't help either. It's almost a reflex to offer consolation in pill form.
I'm sure that didn't make your decision any easier, did it, Andrea? You've had to watch me struggle.
They all sat in silence for a few minutes. The blue skies and the splendor of their elegant surroundings soothed, but didn't assuage the anguish that sat there with them.
So, how are you going to get this guy?
Dottie asked.
He needs to be put away for a very long time.
I'm not sure yet. I came here hoping to find a way to connect Carr, Conroy, and extortion. That's all much clearer now. Using Carr's extortion scheme to get his way at Pinnacle ties the two men together. Conroy's slick, though, so proving that a conspiracy existed between the two men is tough.
Did Eric contact you and ask you to resign?
No. Sally was the bearer of the threat. The "or else" part came a few weeks after the initial onslaught of accusations. She showed up here one day unannounced. Against my better judgment and advice from our lawyer, I let her into the house. There was another round of accusations that her father had been abusing her for years. I asked why she hadn't come to me when it all happened. She went into some mumbo-jumbo about repressed memory. That it was my fault, too, since I was always too busy to listen, and she was afraid to tell me. All these different reasons jumbled up and spilled out in an incoherent way. I suspected she was on drugs of some kind. But if I'd accused her of that, the conversation would have ended right then and there. Instead, I told her I was ready to listen. That must have shocked the hell out of her, or it wasn't in the script. That's when she went ballistic and threatened to go public with her story. Sally said the only way out was for me to give her one last chance at happiness. Resign from the board. Her last words, the last time I ever spoke to my daughter, she screamed at me, "Resign or I'll ruin your life like you've tried to ruin mine. Father will pay too for your stubbornness. This is one fight you will not win, Mother." It wasn't her threats that caused me to resign.
although that part about her father got to me. It was more the realization that I hated being on the board anyway. Pinnacle has asked too much for too long. So I stepped down. The rest, as they say, is history. 2 months later, Sally was dead, and the fix was in on the IPO. I presume he's got the CEO thing wrapped up, too, but no one will talk about succession with an IPO in the making. I hate to ask you to think about this anymore, but was there anything odd about the circumstances surrounding Sally's death? Other than the fact that, as I suspected, she was taking a bunch of drugs prescribed by Carr, no. She'd been on antidepressants before, but never all the other drugs. It wasn't the Xanax and Ambien that killed her, though. Some combination of antidepressants and an antipsychotic drug were at high levels in her system. It was all a horrible accident, according to investigators. I wondered why she was alone. Where was the love of her life? Why did she call her psychiatrist and not Eric when she realized she'd taken the wrong pills, if that's what happened? No one's asked Eric any of those questions, have they? Oh, hell no. There wasn't any reason to question anybody about anything once they ruled Sally's death an accidental overdose. My husband and my daughter are dead because of him. Not only is he going to get away with it, but he's also about to profit from it. That's just wrong. I won't let him get away with it. There has to be a way to stop him. You can count on my prayers, and anything else I can do. With that, Dottie picked up the rosary lying on the table near her plate. The message from Detective Hernandez flashed through Jessica's mind at the sight of those beads. Blood on the rosary, not a match to Libby or Shannon's blood type, the message had read. Did Sally have one of those? Jessica asked, pointing at the rosary. She did, yes. One reason I had hoped things would work out after she left home was that she had rekindled her faith. Father Caverly mentioned how happy he was that Sally had scheduled an appointment with him. He assumed I knew all about it. I was too embarrassed to tell him otherwise, or to ask later why she had made that appointment. What if she had gone to him with those accusations about Harry? It was all I could do to face the man after that. Why do you ask? This is a stretch. We found a rosary, part of one, anyway. It was in a car belonging to Libby Vanderwerf. She's the woman in the ICU who fell off Mount San Jacinto with Dr. Carr and me. Libby thought the rosary was important. The word she used was key. The rosary is the key, or something like that. Dottie sucked in a gulp of air. Like this one, maybe? She asked. Dottie took off a silver chain she had around her neck. On that chain was a tiny key. This key was clasped in Sally's hand when she died. Not the rosary, but a medal and a couple bits of chain from a rosary were in her hand, too. The items were given to me along with her clothes after the autopsy. I decided to wear the key, along with Harry's wedding ring, on this chain around my neck. A silly old woman's attempt to keep her lost family close, Dottie said, her voice breaking as tears fell. Maybe it's what Libby meant, Jessica said softly, as a chill ran through her. Not another suitcase, she thought. Do you have any idea what the key is for? Why would it have been with that rosary? I have no clue why it would have been with the rosary. It had this little loop on it, like it had been attached to a link in the rosary. That's how I got the idea to put it on my chain. It reminds me of the keys that went to the diaries Sally kept. She'd taken them with her when she moved. After she died, I cleaned out her condo and brought them back, along with other small mementos. That included pictures of me and her father. Not a picture anywhere of her fiancé, but her abusive parents, yes. I've thought about reading the diaries, but I just couldn't bring myself to read hateful things about her father or me. I don't understand how it's related to the rosary. You might ask Father Caverly. Maybe she said something to him about it. Dottie dabbed at her eyes. The anger that had energized her earlier had gone now, and she faded into a shadow of her former self, right before Jessica's eyes.
I'm going to take a nap. You're welcome to go through that box of diaries. Take them with you, and the key. Come upstairs with Andrea and me. She'll show you where they are. Bernadette, you should come along, too. Jessica's not in any shape to carry that box. There must be 20 of them, one for each year of her life since she was 10 or 12. With that, their tea party had come to a sad and abrupt end. They walked with Dottie and Andrea through an enormous kitchen to an elevator that took them upstairs. Jessica and Bernadette said goodbye to Dottie. Minutes later, Andrea accompanied them back downstairs and out to the car where Peter and Brian waited. Brian rushed to get that box from Bernadette and loaded it into the back of the car. Neither he nor Peter asked questions, taking their cue from the somber expressions the three women wore on their faces. Please, let there be something in those diaries that will bring Conroy to justice, Jessica thought, as she waved to Andrea. When they settled into the car and buckled up, Peter turned around to head out of the driveway. Jessica looked back at the enormous estate. A woman watched from an upstairs window. Peter, what did you think of Andrea?
Too tall, he said. Not the shooter on Rodeo Drive.
Yeah, okay. That's what I thought. Something's not right about her, though, Jessica said.
Tell him about the key. We found the key and that medal missing from the rosary in Libby's car, didn't we?
Yes, we did. Detective Hernandez needs to check the blood on the crucifix to see if it's a match to Sally Winchester's. Her blood type should be on file at the hospital where she died.
He should have the DNA results soon, too. That's why I put Sally's hairbrush in the box with the diaries, Jessica. You can give it to Jerry to take to Hernandez tomorrow afternoon.
That's primo snooping, Brian said. Do you think that Andrea person saw you? She's stealthy.
Thanks. I don't think she saw me do it, Bernadette said.
I can be stealthy, too, when I need to be.
Are you talking about the woman in the upstairs window, Brian? You could tell it was Andrea?
Yes, and she wasn't just watching us leave. She was on her phone, too, Brian said.
Want to place bets on who she's calling? Peter asked.
A sinking feeling stole over Jessica. The likelihood that it was Eric Conroy made her sick. Whoever she was calling, it can't be good. Do you think Dottie's in any danger?
I don't think Dottie's the one Andrea's calling about, Peter said, making eye contact with Jessica as he peered at her in the rearview mirror. But I can talk to her security guys and get them to check on her if you'd like.
Do it, will you please? Jessica leaned back against the seat while Peter issued commands to the system in the car. He called and expressed his concerns to Dottie's security team, who assured him they would take care of it. They'd place someone in the house with her until further notice from Peter.
Would that be enough to keep Conroy from killing someone else while the clock ticked down the days until that IPO launch? Jessica wondered.
Let's see what Carla Ferguson has to say. We need hard evidence. Maybe she's got it, if there's nothing in Sally's diaries. If Carla will meet with me, she added. And she doesn't just get on a phone like Andrea Jessup and invite Eric to our meeting, she thought, as she leaned back against the seat for the ride back to the hotel. 32. What diaries?
Calm down. Hysteria won't help. Tell me what's happened.
Conroy paced as he listened to the woman speaking on the other end of the phone. Hard to believe a spinster like her could have such a checkered past. You just never could tell, could you? Lucky for him, though, that she, like so many other mousy milquetoast types, had secrets to hide. He had needed eyes and ears on the ground inside that house when Sally had become an iffy resource.
Two women were here, asking Dottie a bunch of questions about Sally. They know about you and Carr, too. They had a key, and they took Sally's diaries.
Who are they? What is going on?
Diaries? What diaries?
Eric asked, almost shouting.
Why is this the first time I'm hearing about them?
Why is this the first time I'm hearing about extortion? Dead women, too, Eric. What have you dragged me into? You said all I was supposed to do was give you updates about what was going on here between Dottie and Sally. Then it was updates about Dottie's condition and any plans she had to inquire into Sally's death. I didn't bargain for getting mixed up in extortion, even though that's what you've been doing to me. Missing women, maybe murdered, is just too much. I want no part of it.
You weren't in a position to bargain about anything, remember? You still aren't. Besides, I've paid you well. Go ahead and squawk about extortion if you want to. Once they peek at your bank account and see money going in, not out, that'll be the end of it. You're mixed up in plenty, though, whether you want to be or not. Now take a deep breath, settle down, and do what you're being paid to do, and give me information.
For the next 10 minutes, he listened. He kept silent, but broke the pencil he was fiddling with when Jessica Huntington's name came up. That she had made a connection between him and Carr disturbed him. That she and the cops were zeroing in on the link to him and Pinnacle was worse. Still, it didn't sound like she had tangible evidence of any wrongdoing. The women who might have evidence weren't talking. Two dead, the third not long for this world, given the reports from the ICU out in the desert. Eric cursed that idiot Carr once more for getting involved with the daffy skirts he was treating. When told to get rid of her, Carr had not hesitated to silence Shannon Donnelly. His ruthlessness had been surprising. Carr had come in handy before that, too, managing Sally, Eric's own foray into the land of daffy skirts. When he got involved with Sally Winchester, he hadn't realized how difficult she would be to control until it was too late.
"Tell me about those diaries and the key," he commanded.
"What's there to tell? Sally kept diaries, a whole box full of them, one for each year. Childish stuff, for the most part. I read through them once they turned up here."
"Okay, so what's in there about me and Carr?"
"You were her one true love. She loved your eyes and the red hair, her very own Prince Harry. She wasn't keen on the goatee. That had to go after you two got married." Andrea laughed when she spoke the next line. "According to Sally, you were the start of her new life. The old one ended." Boy, did she get that right. Prophetic, even, given she was dead a few months later.
"What are you laughing about, you dried-up old hag?" Eric asked.
He felt the need to defend Sally. She had been a lovely thing. It wasn't her fault. Her mother kept her sheltered, naive, and pent up in that gilded cage they called a home. Heck, if things had gone in a different direction, he might even have married her. She would have been a good wife for a CEO. Too bad for him the CEO option didn't happen, and too bad for her that she had a change of heart and became a liability rather than an asset. Not even the good doctor could keep her in line.
"What is it about uppity women?"
he wondered. "If you're done insulting me, I'll hang up now," Andrea sniffed, incensed.
"Spoken in true schoolmarm fashion," he noted. "I don't get it. Are you telling me there was nothing in there about our breakup or seeing Carr for treatment?"
"She was whining about Dottie's disapproval and how misunderstood you were. But no, nothing about a breakup. That would have been this year, though, right? The diaries ended last year."
"There's no diary for this year? Is that what you're saying?"
"Yes, that's what I just said." A note of uneasiness had entered her voice. "I presumed that her last few lines about a new life starting with you ended the Dear Diary era."
"Oh, you presumed, did you? Well, what about that key Dottie was wearing?"
"I didn't know about that key until today. Dottie never said a word about it."
"Were there keys with the other diaries, Andrea?"
"Yes," she said, in a low voice.
"Was one of them missing a key?"
"No. Sally kept a whole set of keys in a jewelry box, each one tagged with the year. One key for each diary," Andrea replied, wariness in her voice now.
"Okay. So where did the key come from that Dottie wore around her neck?"
"Apparently it was among the personal effects Sally had with her at the time of her, death.
weariness had been replaced by a tone of out-and-out stress as she answered that question.
"Here's what you're going to do, Andrea. Go upstairs and search every inch of Sally's room. Look through everything Dottie brought back from her condo, too. Make sure if there's another diary that you get it before someone else does. Got it?"
"Sure. I'll do my best. I can't be too obvious about it, or Dottie and the staff will ask questions. I can go through Sally's room while Dottie's napping. Going through all of Sally's things in storage will have to wait. I can do that after the staff has left and Dottie's asleep for the night."
"Do not wait. Dismiss the staff. Give them the rest of the day off. Whatever it takes to get rid of them. Knock that old lady out cold for a few hours and get it done."
"I can't dismiss the staff, Eric. After that visit from Jessica Huntington, security put a man inside. The best I can do is try to get out to the storage in the garage once it gets dark. There's no guarantee I can do that, but I'll try."
"Trying won't cut it. If you don't get back to me by morning, I'll take matters into my own hands. You don't want me to do that, do you?"
He didn't wait for a response. As soon as he ended the call, he entered another number. He had a new job for Kirk. 33. A tipster. When Jessica returned to the hotel Sunday afternoon, she zipped through those diaries. The first thing she discovered was that the key didn't go with any of the diaries she had. Second, someone had gone through those diaries before her. Otherwise, why were some unlocked while others weren't? Not Dottie, since she said she couldn't bear to read them, and Dottie would have realized the diary that went with the key she wore around her neck was missing. Jessica's first choice as culprit was Andrea Jessup. She could guess about Andrea's interest in reading through the diaries if she was doing Conroy's bidding, but Jessica wanted to quiz her about it. What was in it for Dottie's dutiful assistant? That meant another visit to San Marino, so she could push Andrea for answers. That visit would have to take a back seat to two others, however. Visits with Carla Ferguson and Father Caverly were next on the to-be-interviewed list. Reading those diaries felt voyeuristic, a feeling made worse by the knowledge that their author was dead. They revealed little of value to her investigation, except to confirm that Sally Winchester had been an easy mark for a con artist like Conroy. Though in her 30s, the woman had an almost childlike view of men and a teenaged, rebellious nature toward her parents. Sally poured out her heart about how her mother so misunderstood Eric and vowed not to let Dottie come between them. She was head over heels in love with him, and it was easy to imagine that she would have done anything for him. A breakup would have been devastating, and she would have been putty in the hands of an unscrupulous psychiatrist like Dr. Richard Carr. The real trouble had begun this year when, according to her mother, Sally's life had turned upside down. Too bad, since the last diary had ended on such an upbeat note. As 2012 ended, Sally was convinced her new life had just begun, and the next year would be the best. Her account of what happened after that was missing. Where was the 2013 diary that went with that key? Why did she have the key with her, but no diary? If that diary had been at the hotel the night she died, it would have been among the personal effects returned to Dottie. Where had Carr been the night he called the rescue squad? Perhaps he was in her room that night, found the diary, and took it with him. If so, why? Had the rosary broken during a struggle, cutting Sally's hand and leaving that smear of blood on the crucifix? Was someone after that key? If so, then why was it left behind with Sally's body? Detective Hernandez was looking for a match to the blood and the partial print. Now they knew the remnants of that rosary belonged to yet another troubled woman in Dr. Carr's care. Were there more women? Had one of them fired that shot on Rodeo Drive? Why? How did Libby get the broken rosary months after Sally's death? So many pieces to a puzzle. Her mind was reeling. The solution was tantalizingly close, but close wouldn't get justice for the lives trashed by Carr and Conroy, nor would it stop whatever carnage was yet to come. Hope quieted her torment. Carla Ferguson might have the answers if Jessica had read her right that night in July. Was she a defiant young woman, ready to share her story about the charming psychopath running amok at Pinnacle? She intended to find out. Trying to unravel the dirty secrets behind Carr's manipulation of women wasn't Jessica's only line of investigation. With Bernadette posing as her client and a potential investor, Jessica would ask Carla Ferguson general questions about Pinnacle. What were their goals for the future, earnings potential, further expansion, who would be at the helm, etc., etc., etc.? She would also inquire about the climate in the boardroom, slipping in a question about Dottie Winchester's resignation. Asked tactfully, those questions, too, might pass as nothing more than a potential investor's due diligence. Jessica wanted to see Carla Ferguson's face as she posed questions about the process that led up to Conroy's deal of a lifetime. That wasn't all. She planned to use those questions to work around to even tougher ones. Kim had unearthed Pinnacle financial documents, without saying how she found them, which revealed discrepancies between the materials filed with the SEC and earlier company documents. Jessica had listened to her ex and his cronies whining and chortling about corporate misbehavior long enough to recognize several odd things, such as a long-term account still on Pinnacle's books, doing business with a company that had been a household name but hadn't made it through the Great Recession. Not good. How many other accounts might also be tied to defunct companies? There was also a mysterious drop-off in debts from one year to the next on Pinnacle's books. Drop-off wasn't quite the correct term. If she was reading the materials right, it was as if by magic corporate liabilities morphed into assets. Much of the hocus-pocus was courtesy of their expanded international profile. Pinnacle's corporate wheeling and dealing slid from one part of the world to another. The sudden appearance of off-balance sheet entities is what set off alarms for her. Shades of Enron, she thought. As far as she could tell, debt incurred from expanding Pinnacle's overseas offices one year turned up bundled, securitized, and sold a year or two later by an off-book entity, a Pinnacle subsidiary that dealt in investment products. Perhaps she was missing something. After all, the SEC had been all over Pinnacle's balance sheets before the IPO. Still, the whole point of off-book entities for Enron-like gambits was to remove items from the balance sheets. If you worked in corporate finance at Pinnacle, like Carla Ferguson, it might be something you'd stumble upon. She would start with a few questions and see where all of this took her with the Ferguson woman. The other important thing on her to-do list was a visit with Father Caverly. She hoped he might divulge the nature, if not the specific content, of the discussions with Sally prior to her death. Did she share anything about the accusations made against her father? Or about her relationships with her parents, Conroy, or Carr? Did she raise any red flags about Carr, Conroy, or Pinnacle, and the circumstances surrounding her mother's resignation? Was Sally drugged up and deluded, or a willing party to extortion to help the man of her dreams take his rightful place at the helm of the flagship PR firm? Did her disclosures to the priest signal remorse, a possible precursor to a series of confessions to authorities? Her skin crawled as she recalled the ruthless way in which Carr had reacted to Libby's change of heart. Had Sally Winchester come to a similar turning point? If so, did she overdose accidentally, or did she have a little help from Carr, Conroy, or one of Conroy's hired hands? Jerry was checking to see if he could find any evidence that Carr or Conroy had been out there in the desert when Sally Winchester died. If Sally had called Carr for help, as he claimed at the inquest, maybe he did more than just call 911 on her behalf. The complexity of the case and the chaos of the previous week were getting to Jessica. Angst and weariness warred with her compulsion to put things right. Maybe it was an urge for justice, or a need for the scales of good and bad to be put into balance, an offshoot of her inner control freak. She would be so glad to see this year end. Now only a couple of weeks away. She planned to have a memorable celebration to mark the occasion. If they could nab Conroy, the slithering snake, there would be even more to celebrate. Her cell phone rang, startling her, and she whooped with alarm. "Hi, Frank," she said, recognizing the hunky detective's cell phone number. She tried to calm her racing heart.
"Is that all you have to say?"
Uh-oh. Make that testy, hunky detective, she thought. "I take it you saw that news item about Tiffany's, right?"
"Dad saw it and called me to ask what happened. He tried to call you himself several times today. Dad's more than a little put out about it."
Like father, like son, she thought. She was too tired to wrangle with Frank, though. Several ways to ring out the old year and ring in the new one with the man popped into her head. Maybe it was time to end her no-men vow, along with the year. "I'm sorry. I had the phone off most of the day while I was talking with an old friend about Carr and Conroy. I turned it back on a few minutes ago and didn't even check for missed calls or voicemails." She leaned back on the pillow, trying not to get irritated by Frank's tone. She'd learned that he had a hard time expressing his concern for her in a soft way. At first, anyway, since her apology flipped a switch.
"We were both worried, that's all. You sound tired. Can you tell me what's going on?"
"Sure. It might help me to go through it all. We're brimming over with information, but don't have the missing links to put it all together." She started with the events at Tiffany's. Then she filled him in on what she had learned from Dottie Winchester and her suspicions about Andrea Jessup, the diaries, the tiny key, and plans to speak to Father Caverly all tumbled out. She ran through the issues she had uncovered about Pinnacle without mentioning the fact that she intended to track down Carla Ferguson and have a chat.
"I'll see if I can find out what progress they've made about the shooting at Tiffany's. That's not good, even with an amateur shooting rather than a pro. You already know that, right?"
"Yes, I get it. I've racked my brain trying to figure out who else I could have ticked off enough to shoot me. Could Dr. Dick have another girlfriend on the loose who blames me for shoving him off the mountain?"
"Who knows? It could be. Or maybe the crazed fan idea is right. Does it matter? All the signs are pointing to the fact that you've reached the cool-it point in all of this, as if you weren't already there a week ago when you came within an inch or two of losing your life," he said, with exasperation growing as he spoke.
"I understand that. It's just that we're so close to getting this guy. I can feel it," she said.
"That's what has me worried sick. If you can feel it, maybe he can too."
Frank let out a sigh and took a deep breath.
"I have news about Pinnacle that ought to make it easier for you to take a step back. Please don't repeat this. I have it on good authority that you're not alone in raising concerns about Pinnacle's books. Someone called in a tip that set off an investigation. It's a matter for the FBI, so I can't get the details about how far along they are. But something's up. You need to keep this between us for now."
"Wow, that's great. Is there any tie-in to Carr and what's been going on with the dead and missing women left in his and Conroy's wake?"
"That's a good question. If they get this guy Conroy on a financial crime, maybe the conspiracy with Carr will become evident."
"How about any information about where the tip came from?" That image of Carla Ferguson floated into her head.
"No clue about that either. You've stepped into the middle of another mess for sure. And this one may be above both our pay grades."
"Fell into it is more like it, don't you think? It sounds like I'm on the verge of getting chewed out by federal cops any second now, too. That would be a first."
"They might not be as charming as I am when they pay you a visit. I'm having a wave of regret about not being able to deliver my latest warning in person. On the other hand, just the thought of those lovely green eyes makes it hard for me to be as tough on you as I should be. So better to hear it from me on the phone. Ugh, what am I going to do about you?"
She was back to thinking about plenty he could do, but that wasn't the point. "Tell your dad I'm sorry to worry you both. We have a couple loose ends to wrap up tomorrow, and then it's back to the desert for all of us. I promise." As she hung up the phone, she considered his advice. Why not end her pursuit of loose ends, sleep in tomorrow morning, and hit the spa before driving back to Rancho Mirage? Shopping sounded good, too. Tommy could use some things for his trousseau. Did gay men have those? She looked at the time on her cell phone. Who was she kidding? No way was she going to back off so close to the finish line. Her palm itched as she held the phone, wondering what was still open on Rodeo Drive. What was she going to wear to Pinnacle for that meeting with Carla Ferguson? What would Bernadette wear? She got up and hit the hotel phone line for the concierge. Maybe it was dicey to make the schlep to Rodeo Drive, so why not let them come to her? In minutes, the hotel staff had it all arranged, samples in her size and Bernadette's, from several designers, and a stylist to meet with them, including Tommy and Jerry, who could pick out items for themselves. Tommy and Jerry had decided they wanted to take a South Seas honeymoon cruise, and now they'd have the wardrobe to do it. Over dinner at Spago, she and Bernadette shared what they'd learned from Dottie Winchester with the rest of her Cat Pack pals, including the key and missing diary. She also provided a quick summary of what she found, or thought she'd found, in all that paper about Pinnacle. She also mentioned the brief conversation with Frank, leaving out the part about the other investigation underway into Pinnacle. That retelling of all the intriguing leads uncovered was enough to set her on the trail again. She wanted Conroy to pay for what he'd done to the Donnelly family and the Winchesters, but that wasn't likely to be of much concern to the feds. What difference did it make to the FBI if a louse like Conroy trampled the heart of a young woman on his way to becoming CEO of a billion-dollar company? Trampling hearts was no federal crime. Jessica set out her plans for the next day. Meetings with Carla Ferguson, Father Caverly, and a follow-up with Andrea Jessup. "Why don't you let us follow up with the priest?" Tommy asked. He couldn't hide his happiness about the time spent with the stylist and dinner at the famed eatery. "We can do that while you're meeting with that Ferguson person and Andrea Jessup. Then we can all meet up for lunch and report in before we drive back to the desert. I vote we come back here for lunch with Wolfgang." He had a sublime expression on his face. Since Wolfgang Puck had shown up in person at the restaurant, Tommy was still agog. "Sure, Tommy. Why not?" She sighed. "Since I won't know what's happening at Pinnacle until I try to make an appointment, I doubt I could have gotten all that done tomorrow anyway. Until I have a time set to meet with Carla Ferguson, the rest of my day will be on hold. So, yes, let's go ahead and plan to meet for lunch. Maybe by lunchtime, this whole mess will be over. Wouldn't that be great?" She allowed herself to bask in the glow of that possibility as she sat with her friends. 34. A Mutiny. At 8 Monday morning, she called, asking to meet with Carla Ferguson. As planned, Jessica claimed she and a client were interested in investing in Pinnacle once it went public and had a few questions about the company. As she pointed out to Carla Ferguson's assistant, her client had a substantial investment to make once shares became available on the secondary market. The assistant put Jessica on hold, but was back in an instant and told her Ms. Ferguson had a canceled meeting and would put them in that slot if they could get to her office by 10. If not, they could arrange a meeting for later in the week. She took the 10 o'clock appointment, ended the call, and spoke to Bernadette, who stood nearby in Jessica's hotel room. "My weird luck's working for us today. Pinnacle is in an accommodating posture with that IPO hanging out there, I guess." "Why not? They want that stock price to go up." "Do you think Carla Ferguson recognized your name?" Bernadette asked. "Could be, but I barely remembered her from that encounter at Dad's gala. If she recognized my name because we met at the gala, that could be a good thing. It could explain why she was so willing to meet on such short notice." "Of course, it could also be a bad thing if she recognized Jessica's name and was accommodating her request on Conroy's behalf. The meeting at Carla Ferguson's place of business was on the record, and their arrival would occur in full view of colleagues, so this was no furtive back-alley tete-a-tete. Still, anticipation loomed as Bernadette helped make Jessica presentable. That was easier than it might have been because of their session with the stylist the day before. The stylist had brought her a stunning Versace silk pantsuit in taupe. The sleeves were wide enough to fit over the cast, but not by much. Jessica wasn't ready to wear heels, so she chose a comfortable pair of flats. Sore ribs and the broken arm in a sling remained as the last vestiges of the Mount San Jacinto incident. That is, if you didn't count the intermittent dreams of falling or dangling by a thread, trussed up in climbing gear, or, at other times, stark naked. By 9, they were ready for what should be a 30 or 40-minute drive to Pinnacle. Bernadette was elegant in a Chanel suit with classic lines, but a deeper rose color than the famous suit worn by Jackie Kennedy. Low heels and pearls completed the ensemble. The stylist had called in help for their hair and nails, so they both had she-she do's and perfect nails for the occasion. Jessica was still letting her hair grow out, but it was trimmed, and the blonde highlights were now covered by a glossy brown shade.
"Wow, you two look great," Brian exclaimed. "You look super rich, Bernadette."
As he spoke, he opened the door so they could climb into the back seat of the car. Peter waited behind the wheel.
"Thanks. What makes you think I'm not rich?"
A baffled look swept over his face. As he climbed into the front seat, he answered her.
If you were rich, you'd be retired on a beach in Boca or somewhere, right?
Bernadette just smiled and shrugged.
You do both fit the part, except for that sling.
If anyone asks, I'll blame it on a skiing accident, she said. Fat chance that would work, with all that angel heiress nonsense floating around. No one who knew about it would have to ask her what happened.
I hope no one asks me questions. I don't know much about investing, although your dad has tried to help me out over the years.
That's why you have a legal representative with you. Jessica will do the talking, Peter said, as he pulled away from the hotel entrance.
Whoa, that's like rich people, too. You two have this wired, don't you?
I sure hope so, Jessica replied. She grew quiet as they drove through traffic, heading downtown to the Pinnacle building. They arrived with plenty of time to spare, so went with Peter to park in the garage attached to the building. The lobby area of the Pinnacle building was what you might expect for a PR firm that served members of the power elite. It was replete with gleaming marble, brass fixtures, ambient lighting, and banks of elevators. Security guards were everywhere, wearing blazers and slacks.
What do they think we'd steal? Bernadette whispered.
Clients, or more likely, photos or confidential information about clients. You know how sneaky and resourceful paparazzi or fans can be, Jessica said, as they approached the no-nonsense guard seated at an information desk with a sign asking them to check in. An employee of the firm was signing in ahead of them. The security guy had a build as solid as the marble desk he sat behind.
This is about monitoring the comings and goings of employees, too. All present and accounted for. And if you're let go, you're escorted out of here on the spot.
No chance for you to take proprietary information or client files with you, she whispered to Bernadette.
May I help you? The guard asked when it was their turn.
Jessica gave him their names. He looked at her and then scanned Peter and Brian, who were standing behind her.
They can wait in the lounge, he said, motioning with his head toward a luxurious waiting area.
She could tell Peter didn't like it, but he knew better than to challenge the rules used by security-minded companies, especially companies like Pinnacle that dealt with the high and mighty. On cue, a distinguished-looking gentleman, star of stage and screen, swept into the lobby with his entourage, and she heard Bernadette draw in a breath as she recognized him. In seconds, a squadron of security team members and individuals wearing Pinnacle name badges stepped from a nearby elevator and surrounded him.
"We've got him, Scott. Thanks," a woman called out, along with a code number.
Scott, the guard signing them in, scanned a page in front of him and wrote down the code, or a name, or something. Then he checked the time and wrote that down.
"Not everyone has to wait to be checked in," Bernadette said.
"No, I guess there's a VIP service. Not for his team, though," she said, nodding toward two oversized men who had come into the lobby with the celeb. They headed to the area where Brian and Peter waited.
"Put this on, please, and turn it in here before you leave, Miss Huntington. I'll call to have someone from Ms. Ferguson's office escort you upstairs."
"Thanks, Scott," she said. "See you in a little while." Bernadette clipped her badge to her jacket and then reached over and helped Jessica put hers on. She'd tried but struggled with one arm in a sling.
When they looked up, a well-dressed young woman had appeared in front of them.
That was fast, Jessica thought.
I'm Donna, Carla Ferguson's assistant. Will you follow me, please? Moments later, they were on the elevator. When it didn't stop at Carla Ferguson's floor, Jessica looked at Bernadette. Bernadette knew it, too. Something was up. The elevator finally came to a stop, and the doors opened. They stepped out into a lavish waiting area with startling views of the city below. Without a word, the assistant stepped back into the elevator and disappeared. The Red Devil himself held out his hand in welcome.
What a pleasure to see you again. We met at that gala for your father in July, right, Jessica? May I call you Jessica? And Bernadette, yes?
Eric Conroy was polite enough, friendly even, but didn't wait for either of them to reply to the questions he asked. There was stress in the set of his jaw, just like in that picture where he was shaking hands with the CEO. Jessica suspected that, despite what he said, it was not a pleasure to see her again. When they entered the large office, Carla Ferguson was already there. She didn't even feign pleasure at seeing Jessica when Eric introduced them.
You remember Jessica Huntington, don't you, Carla?
How could I forget? You've been in the news a lot. Somehow, the way those words came out gave her the shivers, like maybe Carla Ferguson was hoping to see Jessica's name in the news again soon, but in the obit section of the L.A. Times. Given all that's been going on, it's hard to believe that investing in Pinnacle is so important to you. That's why I called Eric. I was sure you and your client would prefer to get the answers to your questions straight from the horse's mouth, so to speak. She smiled. Not a friendly smile. A humph erupted from Bernadette as they sat down next to Carla Ferguson and across from Eric Conroy. Jessica was too apprehensive to figure out exactly what Bernadette said in Spanish, but made out the words horse's ass or something like that.
Can we get you a drink, or shall we get down to business?
Conroy asked, still standing behind his desk in the posh office. Jessica wasn't interested in a drink, but she could use a few more minutes to evaluate the situation. Despite the surprise at seeing Conroy when they stepped out of the elevator, she still wasn't that worried. The Cat Pack discussion about the fact that she and Bernadette weren't going it alone echoed with reassurance. If she and Bernadette didn't turn up in an hour, Peter would get antsy. He would ask questions, and if that didn't work, he'd have the authorities upstairs in no time. A drink would be great, she said, examining the expensive digs. It was good to be executive vice president at Pinnacle, except for the way he clenched and unclenched his jaw every so often. The CEO's office must be something to behold, she thought, taking in the opulence in which the second-in-command ruled. She glanced at Carla Ferguson, who was even tenser than Conroy, on pins and needles.
What'll it be?
He asked, pulling out an expensive bottle of cognac from a cabinet nearby. Early in the day for me, even for an exquisite 40-year-old bottle like that. Coffee would be great. Do you have a cup handy? She asked.
Of course. How do you want it?
Black, she replied, in her mind adding, and piping hot, just in case you do something impolite.
How about you, Bernadette?
He asked, as he motioned Carla to fetch coffee from a commercial version of a single-cup brewer system.
I'll have the same, Mr. Conroy, she responded.
On one condition, he said.
What's that?
You call me Eric. You'll soon be part of the Pinnacle family, he said.
Sure, Eric. Why not?
As Carla made coffee, Eric poured himself a glass of the cognac and sat down. The bottle came with him.
It's 5 o'clock somewhere, am I right?
He asked, sipping the tawny-colored elixir. Jessica nodded. She couldn't argue with that. The tension between them was getting to her, and she wondered if it showed.
So, what questions can I answer for you?
What the hell, Jessica thought. Why not lay it all on the table? Before she could speak, though, two things happened. First, Carla set a cup of coffee down on the table next to her chair. Then, a cell phone rang. Jessica reached into her purse and pulled her phone out, but it wasn't hers that had rung.
"Excuse me, please. I need to take this," Conroy said, picking up his cell phone. "Kierkegaard, what can I do for you?"
He was buoyant, expecting good news.
"What do you mean? That's your name, isn't it?"
He chortled, giving Jessica a little wink, as if she were in on his little joke, at the expense of whoever was on the other end of the phone, so it seemed.
"What? What are you saying?"
Jumping to his feet, Conroy blanched as he listened to what Kirk had to say. Carla, who was making a second cup of coffee for Bernadette, turned and stared. Conroy was white as a sheet.
"What is it?"
He didn't respond. Instead, he stepped out of his office, shutting the door behind him. The three women looked up a minute later as the man's voice rose loud enough that they could hear him speaking in the next room. Not that they could make out what he was saying. Carla handed a cup of coffee to Bernadette, her hand trembling a little. Then she sat down, literally on the edge of her seat. When Conroy returned, chewing his bottom lip, his face was suffused with rage. He glanced at Jessica. A cold, hard look was in his eyes that had become dark saucers in his florid face.
"Did you do this?"
He scanned Jessica's face with care.
"Do what?"
she responded, perplexed as a dozen scenarios raced through her mind.
"Someone ratted us out to the feds. Was it you?"
he asked, peering at her as his face flushed deeper with anger.
"No, it wasn't me,"
she replied, still gripping the cell phone she'd taken from her purse. He paused and then gazed at Carla as if he might ask her the same question. The woman was a stone statue perched on her chair. He shook his head. When his eyes returned to Jessica, he spoke again.
"Apparently we have unwanted visitors on their way here. I suppose if you had known about this, there wouldn't have been any reason for your meddling today, right? They've already arrived at Dottie Winchester's estate. Speaking of meddlesome women."
That got Carla's attention.
"Do the authorities have Andrea?"
she asked.
"No. Maybe she's the one who tipped them off. Kirk tells me Andrea was nowhere to be seen when the authorities arrived."
"Who's Kirk? Why would the feds be there?" Carla asked, her eyes pinning him to the spot. "Andrea said Jessica took Sally's diaries and there wasn't anything in them about you or Pinnacle." Jessica and Bernadette snapped to attention. The uneasy feeling she had about Andrea hit Jessica like a kick in the gut. Her hopes that Carla had been the whistleblower to the feds were dashed. Bernadette reached out and picked up that cup of hot coffee. Jessica shut off the sound and slid her cell phone into the sling. Then she picked up her own cup of coffee.
"Who knows what they're looking for? Dottie was on the board here for a long time. Maybe her resignation puts her on the list of go-to people, and they think she has documents or knows something about Pinnacle. Or maybe they think Sally had something important in all her stuff stored at Dottie's house. There's a bunch of hyenas at my house, too, besides the ones stuck in traffic just down the street. Heave-ho, it's time to shove off. Launch Plan B, now. Send the orders,"
Conroy said, downing the remaining cognac in his glass. Carla was searching for something on her cell phone. She hit a button, presumably sending a text message relaying those orders about Plan B. With that, Conroy moved into action. He opened a safe, hidden by a painting hanging on the wall behind him. Pulling a leather portfolio from the safe, he unzipped it. In his haste, items fell from it. That included money and identification documents that he scooped up, putting a packet of cash into his suit pocket as he shoved items back into the portfolio.
"Here, just in case we're in a hurry later."
He tossed what looked like a passport to Carla, along with another neatly wrapped stack of bills.
"How are we going to get out of here if the building will be crawling with federal agents any minute?"
Carla was standing now, poised to run.
"You're right. We need a distraction, don't we?"
He eyed Jessica. No way was she going to be his distraction. If he took one step toward her, hot coffee was going into his face. Quick as lightning, he stuffed papers from his safe and desk into a trash can that he picked up. He set the can up on a shelf, right under the ventilation duct. Picking up the bottle sitting on his desk, he poured the rest of the 90-proof cognac over the papers. Then he took several cigars from a box and stuffed them in a pocket. Then he dumped the rest into the trash can, lit a cigar, and tossed it in, too. The contents caught fire, and smoke curled up toward the vent. At the same time, he hit a button, and an alarm wailed. The office was filling with smoke, although the ventilation